The following podcast was produced after the workshop, Chinese Objects Outside of China, which took place at Winterthur Museum, Garden, and Library from June 5th to June 9th, 2017. The workshop is part of the Chinese Object Study Workshops program administered by the Freer Gallery of Art and the Arthur M. Sackler Gallery, the Smithsonian's Museums of Asian Art, and sponsored by the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation. My name is Susan Eberhard, and I am a PhD candidate in the Art History Department at UC Berkeley. I'm writing a dissertation on the global circulation of Chinese silver made for export in the 19th century. Accumulation, density, expansion and containment. I keep returning to this set of words when thinking about this scallop-shaped serving dish. Around 1868, it was ordered in Hong Kong and shipped from Guangzhou, carefully created along with 315 additional matching objects as a dinner service for Ulysses S. Grant and his wife, Julia Dent Grant. From a distance, the surface is like an interlocking gold and green brocade. It opens to reveal four painted scenes spinning around a central disc, rimmed in gold and bearing a monogram of Grant's initials, USG. A laurel wreath connoting victory and valor surrounds the insignia, a not-so-subtle reminder of the quelling of rebellion in which Grant recently played a critical role. The insignia operates as if to bring masculine military order to the profusion of nature, the riot of vines and peonies, and culture, the delicate quotidian scenes in the reserve vignettes. It is the cultivation and prosperity of peacetime after the resolution of violence, a garden bound by a gilded perimeter. All very fitting for a martial leader who was around this time transitioning into a civic authority as President of the United States. But looking closer at the dish, an initial impression of repose, containment, and stability is quickly overturned. The enamels are caked in some areas and oxidized in others. Textures range widely, from barely there transparent films to thick pools of frit. Even more disjunctive is the way different enamels, gilding and the porcelain, refract light. The gold gilding shines brightly, while the green-blue overglaze enamel in the figural scenes has an iridescent gleam. The vitreous porcelain body flatly absorbs light. And perhaps it need not be said, but the designs are not consistently Roman in reference along with the medallion, but rather are generalized versions of Chinese figural scenes, bird and flower paintings, and flora, abstracting from the history of Chinese material culture, art, and design. The dish raises the question of why such a design, known by porcelain collectors as the rose medallion pattern, would be so desirable to the Grants that they would order such an unusually large service of 315 objects. In the late 19th century, elite entertaining and dining practice had shifted from dining à la française, in which all the food would be served at once on a range of platters, stands, and dishes, to dining à la russe, where each course was brought out individually. Even so, when the service was used, presumably, it would provide a vast stage upon which meats, sauces, starches, soups, and sweets would be arranged for luxurious delectation. Yet, I imagine the sensuous experience of smelling, seeing, and even tasting your dinner would be in serious competition with the rose medallion service. The contingency of texture in the enamels and their tonal variants meant to evoke oil painting would both seem to either clash with or enhance the aesthetic of dining. I personally am far more accustomed to eating from white or monochrome dishes, which serve to direct your focus on the colors and flavors of the food, so I don't know which is more likely. But even beyond the sensory overload of the surface, at a material level, there is also the imagination of an exotic, civilizational, and cultural other at play. As it's been closely tracked by cultural historians and aesthetic theorists, chinoiserie designs are inscrutable or romantic evocations of China perceived at a remove. They allow for fantasy and open-ended desire. There is an erasure of any empathetic understanding of material or cultural conditions, far less the self-definition of Chinese subjects. Cultural historian David Porter has argued that from the 16th to the 18th centuries, China could serve for Europe as a subject of fascination and eroticism, an ancient culture replete with an excess of meaning that is nonetheless unintelligible. In the 18th century and later, he notes a shift in the European and then American perception from regarding China as a bastion of legitimacy and continuity to a stagnant and effeminate empire. For Porter, China at this time in the cultural imagination of the West becomes a mere glossy surface, insubstantial but titillating, an enchanting void out of which could be conjured the style of Rococo, the Oriental Garden, and the chinoiserie forms. This might be found whirling around the surface of plates, cavorting across fabrics, and certainly can be experienced firsthand in Wuchter's China Room, transforming entire interiors into an escape port to the Orient. Track further into the 19th century, which is, of course, the period of our plate, we are brought to an era of solidifying nation-states and imperialist ambition. Against the development of these new forms of sovereignty, China is redefined at its root as backwards, a civilizational opposite. Within expanding forms of consumer culture, paralleled by the expansion of forms of commerce abroad, protected by naval force, this chinoiserie serving dish and its 314 mates can be coded as a fantasy of control over the other, at once replete with and lacking cultural content. Even perhaps a form of military control, if we might imagine a battalion of the following, arranged in some evenly spaced order, down a long table, at different points during a meal, all clad in the same uniform. So according to one scholar's speculative reconstruction, the grand service consisted of 60 dinner plates, 30 soup plates, 60 dessert plates, 60 bread and butter plates, 36 demitasse cups, 36 demitasse saucers, two platters with strainers or trivets, one covered soup tureen, two covered sauce or gravy tureens, three tureen trays, two punch bowls, 10 covered vegetable dishes, some oval, some rectangular, one covered hot water dish, two shell-shaped serving dishes, of which this is one, two kidney-shaped serving dishes, two rectangular serving dishes, one square-shaped serving dish, and a lozenge-shaped serving dish. In all, a striking statement of taste and force. But can we simply say that it is one that betrays power, pleasure and power through possession of the irreconcilably different, the historically eroticized and exoticized, but now denigrated other. For me, David Porter's tracking of the cultural work of the Orient is convincing in explaining large-scale patterns of coordinated response of the European world to China. But he remains at the level of discourse. And thus, he overlooks the continuing fascination of Orientalist collectors and sinologist scholars with the products of Chinese culture, including its language, its objects, and religion, as well as the ongoing importance of on-the-ground trade and later consular activity. This is not to say that the Qing Empire wasn't regarded by many in power as stagnant and anti-modern. Its resistance to unfettered trade, especially an endless frustration, but I would argue that curiosity towards difference, albeit in many cases of exoticizing the plumeless cultural depths of an ancient culture, continued, though they were certainly conversant with these more hawkish agendas. The School of Porter also overlooks the Chinese designers, makers, traders, and merchants as a source of these objects. Ignoring their role in their creation and circulation, as well as other cultural groups who ordered services in this pattern, perhaps gives too much agency to the Western consumer in relating the biography of these objects. However, Not too much is yet known about how this pattern was developed and for whom. The rose medallion pattern is one of several that uses the Fimi rose palette, so identified through a connoisseur's taxonomy developed in the mid-19th century by Albert Jacquemart. It is marked by the use of a pink translucent glaze and a central medallion or circular reserve. Some of the earliest documented examples of the pattern were made for the Middle Eastern market, and specifically for Persians in the 1850s. These objects often bear Arabic inscriptions. So while it is difficult to know how the pattern for the service was initially developed, by and for whom, it apparently appealed to multiple markets. And also, very early on in its known history, to markets aside from the British naval empire, and later, the expansionist trade and military aspirations of the U.S. Even so, it clearly was a design that appealed to the American architects of the latter, meaning the qualifications for luxurious dining among a set of statesmen and naval elite that rose to power during the Civil War and thereafter. So, for the Grants were not alone in their preference for rose medallion. This was, in a sense, and likely for most, an act of emulative consumption. John Quinton Fuller was a historian who has done the most work in terms of tracing both the history of this individual serving dish and other examples of the rose medallion service. He apparently also was an art thief who, according to a 1991 profile in the New York Times, stole over 100 objects, mostly Chinese export porcelain, from 8 major museums, making him one of the most prolific art thieves of the last 100 years. Irregardless, his many articles and, one might say, his acquisitive eye, at least can tell us something about the history of a taste for the rose medallion pattern in the British and American markets. Feller has written that the earliest example for the American market he has come across is one likely made for President James Buchanan, though the documentation is mostly circumstantial. Others with a better history of ownership in connection to Grant include William H. Seward, the Secretary of State under Lincoln and Andrew Johnson, as well as one owned by Surgeon General Joseph Barnes, now at the Smithsonian. Seward actually commissioned the service to give as a gift to Barnes, who saved his life after one of John Wilkes Booth's co-conspirators stabbed him the night Lincoln was assassinated. Seward asked Barnes how he might thank him with a gift, and Barnes suggested he might order him a version of the service he had long admired in Seward's possession. Barnes's rose medallion service is quite interesting in that it bears a transliteration of his name, his position, and Seward's name, all in Chinese. Additionally, Grant likely knew Rear Admiral Silas H. Stringham on a professional basis, who also owned a rose medallion pattern dinner service. The Grants doubtless encountered the pattern on one or more of these tables within the social milieu of Washington, D.C., in the immediate post-bellum period. Clearly, it left a deep and lasting impression, leading to their pursuit of a similar design for their own entertaining purposes. Thanks to Feller, we have an unusually clear picture of how this was transacted through surviving correspondence. Using letters between the Grants and Ulysses' childhood friend, Daniel Amen, he has traced the conditions under which the service was commissioned and obtained. Emin was a captain in the United States Navy. He was deployed in the so-called Asiatic Squadron following the Civil War and the relaunching of the U.S. naval presence worldwide. Emin also ordered himself a service about half the size of the Grants after his ship, the Piscataqua, anchored in the Hong Kong Harbor in May 1868. Oliphant and Company, the long-standing American trading concern, was charged with its commissioning, decoration, packing, insuring, and shipping back to the United States. Now, nonetheless, Amman kept close tabs on the service's production, and furthermore kept Mrs. Grant, then living in Washington, in the loop as to the set's location and situation. From the port of Yokohama in August 1868, Amin wrote, "On our reaching the coast of China about November 1st, I suppose, your ware will be completed, and it is not at all unlikely that I will ship it by a sailing vessel so as to have it reach home by the time or soon after you have to remove to the White House. I am quite content with the ware, and doubt not that they will fail to realize your expectations." According to family lore, the set reached the White House in the spring of 1869, just after Grant's first inauguration. It is fascinating to think about these prominent buyers of the Rose Medallion service, vested with military and naval power, and then later state power, as tastemakers. Grant, his wife, and Amin seized the occasion of Amin's deployment to China to acquire large matching services in a particular pattern. But why else was Amin there, from a naval strategy perspective? On April 23, 1866, the U.S. deployed its naval squadrons following a lengthy hiatus due to the Civil War. These include the North Atlantic Squadron, the European Squadron, the South Atlantic Squadron, the South Pacific Squadron, the North Pacific Squadron, and the Asiatic Squadron. According to the Secretary's report, quote, "the vessels of each squadron will be required to visit, alternatively, all the places within the limits of the command, where American commerce extends," end quote. So the squadron regularly visited all the open ports of China at one level to ensure the safety of the trading and consular activities of American citizens posted there, but also presumably to remind inhabitants of the military power that backed them, such as it was at that time. The squadron also visited ports in Japan, others in Asia, and on the eastern coast of Africa. Finally, it tried to suppress the pirates, the inevitable pirates. The American Navy presence in Asia was relatively small, and it is worthwhile to note that it wasn't necessarily the most cutting edge and adept at what it was doing. In his autobiography, Daniel Amin writes that after the resolution of the war, he was ordered to the Piscataqua, bound to the Asiatic station, but he really didn't want to go. He said that a friend had asked him if he was willing to be ordered, and he replied, in his belief, "belonging to a service implied an obligation to serve, and he had, quote, always endeavored to fulfill this obligation." However, it was a disappointment, he writes, as he had really hoped to get command of a vessel to go to the coast of Alaska to ascertain the existence of cod and halibut fishing grounds and of timber suitable for naval purposes, which I thought from my reading would be of especial value along the banks of the Yukon River. In his autobiography, Amin mentions the U.S. acquisition of the Alaskan territory earlier in the context of a meeting with Grant during the war. At that time, he was presenting it as news to the general, who hadn't heard, and didn't at that much time have much of an opinion. Amin, however, was very pleased by the strategy of the acquisition, which would, after the influx of great populations due to deep-sea fisheries, as he projected, would, quote, "secure to us the control of the Pacific. No nation would be disposed to dispute our supremacy of those seas when our advantages were so obvious." And so when he is saddled instead with a disappointing assignment to the China station, he spends several pages grumbling about the outdatedness of the Piscataqua, fitted as it is, with the wrong kind of smokestack, which he actually titles objectionable, for traversing vast oceans. In sum, Amin was full of complaints about his posting. China, for him, was not really a source of strategic interest, and the U.S. Navy was ill-equipped to get there in the first place. The 1860s, one peak of popularity of the Rose Medallion service, is just too early in U.S. history to connect any policy of imperialism in East Asia with its design. What might it have signified, then, for present-day for President-elect Grant and his wife, as well as others who purchased it? After about a year in the White House, Grant acquired a 587-piece porcelain service through the French-American firm Haviland & Company, produced in French at Limoges. Much like a man, Charles E. Haviland personally oversaw the commission. The painter Lizac, head of Haviland's decorating department, contributed drawings of flowers that Haviland described as, quote, accurate, simple in arrangement, and beautiful. While the flowers are different from plate to plate, they are all centered in the middle of the plate against a white porcelain background. With a beige band on the lip and a gilded, softly scalloped rim, the plates are certainly quite simple in comparison to the dense rose medallion service. Further, the design was not affected in heavy overglaze enamels, but through a combination of printing and hand painting, a technique that works to erase any evidence of fracture. In contrast to the dense accumulation of the rose medallion services, the spare elegance recalls the Greek revival sets, also commonly made in China in the late 18th century. These have been linked by design scholars to the self-identification of the new nation with Greek democracy and Roman valor. After Grant's second term, Julia and Ulysses personally visited China. Here they acquired several more additions and close relations to their rose medallion service. They also went to Japan, where they were treated as state visitors and presented with an important service known as the Mikado porcelain. So while I don't have a firm answer to my question of why the accretion and the heterogeneity of the rose medallion service was so appealing to a particular set of postbellum military and governmental elite, it seems to be linked to a personal taste and aspiration as opposed to their official capacities, as might be demonstrated through the sensual differences in the Grant's official French maid and personal Chinese maid services. Doubtless there's an element of exoticism, but also one of intimate personal connection to China, imagined or not. In his autobiography, Amin describes a visit to a wealthy Chinese acquaintance from Guangzhou who had taken up residence in Singapore. He had sent his son to be educated in Boston. Amin is clearly impressed by the clean and well-kept animals the man keeps in his gardens, including an enormous boar, other pigs, monkeys, fishes, and even a baboon. They all are tended by a keeper. The boar was so old that its tusks almost wrapped around over themselves. Amin remarked that in the U.S., pigs hardly survive past the age of two since they are killed to be eaten. I can conceive the feeling of pity, Amin wrote, that my host may have felt toward me at my remark, that a hog should not be allowed to reach the age of 2 years, when these animals were maintained in comfort as a token of gratitude for the blessings which he and his family enjoyed. He was a Buddhist, and his peace offering was the care of these animals. Within context of military confrontation, trade imbalance, incipient semi-colonialism, and profound prejudice and misunderstanding, there are also these moments of seeing oneself in the context of a different worldview. And of course, this sentiment comes with a heavy dose of eat, pray, love, but I hope to have at least offered a different way of thinking about the taste that these scallop-shaped services carried, from an expansionist abstraction of China to one more gritty and granular.